Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about everything and anything having to do with writing. Today, my guest is acclaimed children's book author Jane Yolen. Her books, stories, and poems are included in more than 100 textbooks at all grade levels, and she's written or edited more than 200 books for children, young adults, and adults. Ms. Yolen has won numerous awards such as the Caldecott Medal, Nebula Award, and Golden Kite Award by the Society of Children's Book Authors or Writers. Her books are frequently chosen as featured selections by book clubs, including the Book of the Month Club and the Literary Guild. Newsweek magazine has called Jane Yolen the Hans Christian Andersen of America because of her lyrical writing style, use of folklore and legends as the basis for contemporary stories, and her skill as an oral storyteller. In 1993, the New York Times Book Review said, "If there were a modern equivalent of Aesop, it would probably be Jane Yolen." Her work has appeared in magazines and books all over the world. She is quite something. Are you with us, Jane?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. I'm so glad to have you with us. How do you get so much done?
Somebody once asked me if I had captured the time fairy. I'm just one of these compulsive people, I suppose, or obsessive, you might say. I love to work. I love to write. And there's nothing more enjoyable than having a story compounding out. I don't enjoy the business part of it. But I love the writing part.
How did you come to writing? Have you always been a writer since you were a little kid?
Yeah, both my parents were writers. I mean, my father was a journalist and a cafe journalist and then a foreign correspondent. And my mother was really a failed short story writer in that she wrote short stories but only sold one in her life. And everyone they seemed to know, all the adults, were writers. So my childhood assumption was that every grown-up is a writer. Of course, I found out later that wasn't so, but that's up until I was probably about 8 or 10 years old, that's what I really thought.
So is that your earliest memory in terms of what you saw yourself becoming?
Yes, yeah. Well, I knew that every grown-up was a writer, but they had other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So, because I knew that I had a teacher and a doctor, and there was a butcher on the corner, and, you know, there was a man who sold the newspapers. But I thought they all went home at night.
Interesting.
So when I thought about it at all, you know, when some adult said, "What are you going to be when you grow up?" I would say, "I'm going to be a writer and I'm going to be." And my other choices when I was little was a ballet dancer, and then a horse trainer, and then a lawyer. But I also knew I was going to write.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I saw you more than a year ago, it must have been, on the book show on C-SPAN 2.
Uh-huh.
And, excuse me, the camera was focused on you, and you were responding to an interviewer. And when you were through responding, the camera then focused on the children you were talking with, who were in the role of being the interviewers. And I was very impressed with how you talked with them. You didn't talk down. It was as if you were talking... as if you were really talking with an adult. And
well, first of all, they were very smart kids. But I always feel, and I do this with my own children, was that if they have legitimate questions, whether you've heard the questions before or not, you have to give those questions your serious attention, which means you have to give the kids your serious attention.
Mm-hmm. So you seem naturally empathetic with children, and I'm curious if it's always been that way, and if that's part of what makes you write so wonderfully for them.
Well, you know, I wish I could say yes. I mean, yes, I have always been empathetic with kids, though I think as I get older, I have less patience with any child outside of my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, there are some wonderful, important, innovative, original children's book writers who've never had children of their own. you know, people like Maurice Sendak.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very dangerous to make that assumption. And then there are a lot of people who have children and are wonderful with children who couldn't write their way out of a paper bag.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's important for children's book writers to be in touch with the child inside, not necessarily remembering their own childhood. I have actually very little memory of my childhood. I have flashes, but most of my concrete memories come after about seventh grade. But I think that inside, I'm still probably around 8 years old.
And that helps.
That helps.
So from the time you knew you were going to be a writer, was it children's books you knew
no.
you would write?
No, it was going to be poetry.
Mm-hmm. And you are a poet.
Yes.
I see here on your resume.
Yeah. And I do write some adult poetry. But most of my poetry now is for children.
Mm-hmm.
Partially because I'm good at it, and you like to do what you're good at. And partially because I think as an adult poet, I have some wonderful lines, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they're great poems.
Well, the children's books of yours that I've seen seem very poetic.
Yes.
Is that some, I mean, it must not be an effort. It must just flow.
No, my poetry for children or my writing for children has two completely opposite poles. I've got the Owl Moon poetic,
mm-hmm.
which is very soft and inward and full of metaphor or simile, trying to construct the child voice. But then I have a new book coming out called How Does a Dinosaur Say Goodnight, and it's just bumpy rhyme, you know, just absolutely wild, fast, funny, silly, easy to memorize rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I do both.
Why don't you read something for us?
Well, why don't I start with How Does a Dinosaur Say Goodnight?
Okay. And this is a book coming out soon?
It's a book that's coming out in, I guess, February, March, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a copy. and the pictures are by Mark Teague, who I've never done a book with before, but he is absolutely irrepressible. His dinosaurs are brash and silly and funny, and yet they seem to capture childhood, too. And you'll hear me turning pages. How does a dinosaur say goodnight when Papa comes in to turn off the light? Does a dinosaur slam his tail and pout? Does he throw his teddy bear all about? Does a dinosaur stomp his feet on the floor and shout, I want to hear one book more? Does a dinosaur roar? How does a dinosaur say goodnight when Mama comes in to turn off the light? Does he swing his neck from side to side? Does he up and demand a piggyback ride? Does he mope? Does he moan? Does he sulk? Does he sigh? Does he fall on the top of his covers and cry? No, dinosaurs don't. They don't even try. They give a big kiss. They turn out the light. They tuck in their tails. They whisper, good night. They give a big hug. Then give one kiss more. Good night. Good night, little dinosaur. So that's how dinosaurs say goodnight. Of course, you're missing the best part of it without seeing the pictures. The pictures are so wonderful.
Speaking of the pictures, now, do you have any influence on the illustrations that accompany your words at this point? Or how does
yes
that work?
Yes and no. I mean, I have, my husband and I are doing a web page now, and I have, over 100 picture books. Some of them, I know the illustrators. Some of them, I've never met the illustrators. Some of them, the illustrators contacted me and said, can you give me some insights? Most of the time, the illustrators want me to stay as far away as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I've discovered illustrators like Jane Dyer and Lauren Mills and Barbara Berger and brought them to the attention of the publishers. And other times, as in this case, I didn't know Mark Teague. I had only seen one other of his books, and the editor said to me, we have to have Mark Teague, you know, and she showed me the rest of his work, and I just fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm. So is the first time you see the illustrations when the book comes out, or is there some point before that
I usually see sketches or a book dummy. But editors don't necessarily always do that on their authors. But I've been an editor.
Oh.
So they look at me as a colleague, I think, as much as an author, and they treat me as such.
Mm-hmm. I imagine the way your work is submitted now to publishers is quite different than when you started out, but maybe you could talk a bit about that, because I think some children's writers who have never been published, who would love to be published, are under the impression that as well as writing the book, they should also provide illustrations, however rough, for the publisher.
No. Bad mistake. Bad mistake to ever provide illustrations if you're not a highly competent professional illustrator, because a publisher looking at your weak attempt to just show what you mean in illustration, or if your best friend has done it for you, or your wife or your husband or your significant other, they'll reject the book on the grounds that they don't like the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want anything to stand in the way of your manuscript and the editor's enjoyment of it. One of the things that children's book editors are very good at, and that's why they're children's book editors, is that they're very visual, and they can visualize how the book is going to look. And what the author has to do once the book is taken is to sit down with the editor, face-to-face if possible, on the phone if not possible, and discuss the look of the book so that you're both on the same wavelength. I mean, if I'm saying, I see Dr. Seuss, and the editor's saying, well, I see Maurice Sendak, then you're probably not on the same wavelength yet.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Jane Yolen. In terms of working with editors, how does that typically go? You hand in your manuscript, and the next step is getting it back with marks of suggested changes. What happens?
I think as many editors as there are, that's as many different ways there are to work,
mm-hmm.
or as many authors as there are. Some editors, I can tell them an idea, and they say, let's do it, and I'll get a contract. Other editors want to see the complete finish, every dot dotted, every T crossed. But no matter how you sell it, how you first get it to the editor and the editor then accepts it, after that the process becomes the editor reads it once, twice, three, four times, however many times they need to. They write notes and they give you the notes, or they send you a letter telling you. I always insist that they tell me something nice first, please, before they give me the revision letter. Tell me you love me. I was just having this conversation online with some people who were saying they didn't think editors edited anymore, and that's not true in children's books. In children's books, children's book editors are the most careful and sensitive and thorough editors I know.
Hmm.
I've written adult novels where they tell me, oh, just take out a couple of the exclamation points. Well, in fact, I don't use exclamation points. So, so that was not a helpful editorial direction.
Mm-hmm. So they're more careful with children's books. That's interesting.
Well, you know, you have a shorter book. You have fewer words. Every word has to count.
Mm-hmm.
In an adult book, sometimes you can lose 40 pages and nobody would know.
You write for children, you write for young adults, you write for adults. Now, do you enjoy one over the other, or is that like asking the mother of many children who her favorite is?
That's exactly the answer I give when people ask. Actually, the thing that most engages me is the book I'm working on at the moment that somebody asks me. Because I've been writing now for closing in on 40 years professionally. Many of the things that people come to and love are 30 years, are older than my children, who are all grown up and have their own children.
Mm-hmm.
And so if somebody comes to me and is with a blush of enthusiasm, I love this book and yada, 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 I can't remember it that well. unless I don't go, I don't sit and read my own books once they're published, unless I'm doing a reading. Because, quite frankly, I've read them already any number of times, and I'm more interested in other people's writing.
Tell me about reading and about being a storyteller. Is that different? Is that a different avenue for you than the writing?
Reading and writing and telling stories are three very different activities. I think they engage very different parts of the brain, and they certainly engage very audiences very differently. If I am reading, or indeed if I'm writing, it's a very solo activity. I control the pace and can skip if I'm reading. I can go back and reread stuff. I have a very intimate connection with the story, but I have an interesting control over it as well. If I'm storytelling, or if I'm in the audience for storytelling, I'm engaged with that story in a more linear fashion, because I can't ask the storyteller to go back. Whoops, I missed that part. Would you go back? Or if I'm the storyteller, I can't say, oh, you know, that was such a nice part, I think I'm going to tell it to you again. It just isn't on in storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, there is a different kind of intimacy with a storyteller and an audience. You're eye to eye. I can tell when a story is not working, when my audience looks at me and their eyes are kind of skating over the surface of my face and going somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I can take longer when I'm writing a story that's to be read, because I know either they'll skip over it or they'll savor every word. But when I'm telling a story, I'm constructing it differently.
Now, I heard somewhere that you write many books at once and that you have different books running in different rooms.
Well, not exactly different rooms, no. But I do write a number of things at once. I cannot write two major novels at the same time, because you have to take a bath in your novel. You have to be absolutely covered up, you know, above your eyeballs in it when you're working on a novel, because there's so many parts to it, and you've got to keep control, and it has to have its own voice. And if you are working on two running, at least if I am working on two running simultaneously, that's where I get confused. But I can be working on a book of poems and a book of stories and a picture book or two or three or four, and a novel at the same time. In fact, right now I'm working on a collection of cat stories. I'm working on a book of poems with my son, who's a photographer. I'm just finishing a novel that I'm writing with a friend, and I'm just started. Oh, and I wrote a little picture book. Worked on a little picture book the other day. I have a couple of other picture books going. So yeah, I can do probably up to about 7 or 8 things at the same time, but they're not always going at the same rate.
Mm-hmm.
I may be well into something, and I may be stuck on something else, and I never get writer's block because I have enough things going.
Mm. Do you think that's the key to not getting writer's block, is having more than one project?
Well, it has been for me.
Mm-hmm.
It has been for me. And I could get blocked on 3 or 4 or 5 things and still have 4 or 5 things that I could still do.
Because I think that's another thing writers do. They focus on one project, and if they can't move on it, they just don't do anything that day.
Yeah. Well, I have been stopped on projects for months at a time, but I just simply put them away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know that I will come back to them. I know that they will become alive again in me at some point, but I can never project when.
So you typically finish everything you start?
No. I have a file, an enormous file, full of ideas that never got past 1 or 2 lines. And then I have file folders of things. I mean, I have one novel that I keep going back to that I have 8 chapters written already. But there are times in your life when you're not ready to write things. And there are times when something else forces itself to the forefront, and you have to give it attention.
Mm-hmm. You collaborate quite a bit, it sounds like. How is that? How is that for you? How do you decide who is? Does one person sort of have more power in the project? Does it depend who gets the project going or whose idea?
Very astute question, because I've worked recently with two different guys on projects, and they were very, very different. I did a book called Armageddon Summer with Bruce Coville. Bruce and I are on the same level professionally. We both have lots of books out. We both have popular books out. But he usually writes very funny, fast, books. And I tend to write less fast, less funny books. But because we were both on the same level, we had to find a way to work on the book that gave us both equal power. And what we did was we ended up having two major voices in the book, and I wrote the girl's voice and he wrote the boy's voice. We would then read one another's things and critique it, but I had final say on the girl's stuff. He had final say on the boy's stuff.
That's interesting.
Now, I've also just finished a book that'll be out this spring called Queen's Own Fool, which is a novel of Mary Queen of Scots, because I discovered that Mary Queen of Scots had three female jesters. This is true.
That's interesting.
And once I learned that, I knew I had to tell this story. So a Scottish friend and I worked on it, and he has never had a novel published, though he's also worked with his wife, who is a well-known fantasy writer. And his name is Robert Harris, and Bob and I work in a very different way. He's wonderful at plot and at just sort of battling out huge chunks of a book. We would sit and talk about where the book was going. He'd battle out a huge chunk of it, but it was really all narrative. And I had to take it and make it into scenes and dialogue and character. And that's how we worked.
Mm-hmm.
Very different from the way Bruce and I worked. And as senior writer with Bob, I got final say. I did the final passes on the book. And then I did the final revisions on the book.
Mm-hmm. So you work it out to begin with, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. Though I must say that both times my name went first. But in both instances, the books were both my ideas, which is why my name went first. Probably not a good idea, since C and H come well before Y.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Jane Yolen, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. You sound so busy. I said that at the beginning. Do you have any leisure time? Well, I mean, what's a typical day like for you?
Typical work day, get up at 6:30, get online for about an hour, pick up messages, and then I will work on writing projects till around noon, take a break, have sort of breakfast, lunch, shower. The nice thing about being a writer is you never have to apologize for being in your jammies. In the afternoons, normally I would do business stuff. We have a house that we live in Scotland in the summertime. And I used to think that I was a morning writer. That was it. My head cut out at 2 in the afternoon. I could no longer think creatively. Once we started going to Scotland in the summers, where you have light until about 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered that I could write until 9, 10, because it was the light, not the morning.
Mm-hmm.
That was what was good for me.
Interesting.
So my rhythms in Scotland are a little different than my rhythms are here in the States. But for leisure, I do a lot of traveling. My husband and I do antiquing. We have three granddaughters who are visiting our children at their houses a lot. I work with my children, too. I do books with each of them. My daughter and I write books together. My son, Adam, is a musician, and we've done 8 music books together.
Mm.
And we're about to start on another one, and we've also done, I've written some songs with him. And we've done, he has a small record company, we've done a spoken arts CD for him. And my youngest son is a photographer, and I've done 5 books with him, and we have 2 more under contract coming out. where he does photographs and I do poetry. Mm.
How wonderful to collaborate with your children.
Well, they're all very interesting kids. Oh, I guess you can't call them kids when they're...
they'll always be your kids.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. Please stay tuned. Jane Yolen will be back. Just a few minutes, enough time for her to take a sip of water, for you to get up and stretch. So stay tuned. Don't go away. We'll be right back. My guest is Jane Yolen. Welcome back. Jane, what does it mean winning so many awards? How does that affect your writing?
Well, the only time it really affects the writing is when you have to go and collect the awards. awards kind of sit on your desk or wherever and collect a lot of stuff, I'm afraid. In fact, one award actually set my good coat on fire. So
what was that?
Sometimes it can be hazardous.
What set you on fire?
Well, it was a magnifying. It was called a Lensman Award. And it was a magnifying glass that I set on top of a of a lovely piece of wood, and I had it displayed in the kitchen on a what had been a cold, wintry, gray February week, and all of a sudden it got to be nice, and the sun came blazing through the window and through the lens and set my coat on fire. So I naturally then felt I had to keep the award where the sun doesn't shine.
That's cute. Publishing, how has it changed since you've started?
Well, I got in at a time when I think it was easier for new voices to be heard. At a time when editors were the loudest voices in the publishing company. Now I'm afraid the marketing people are much louder. The tail wags the dog, the Barnes & Nobles and the Amazon.com and all those people are make their voices louder than the editorial voices.
Mm-hmm.
So that if a book is not a major bestseller, it's considered not any good. I think it's harder for new people to get started now. Harder to be found, and harder to be nurtured through those first one or two or three books where you're finding your voice and your style. I'm sure you've heard this before.
Mm-hmm. Well, the internet, how does that affect selling books? Do you think that because there's an Amazon and a BarnesandNoble.com and an online bookstores that more books are being sold, or do you just think it's another way of selling them?
The publishers tell us that more books are being sold than ever before. I do hear from a lot of people that they research their books on Amazon and then go and buy it at their local independent store,
mm-hmm.
which I find a very interesting phenomenon, which may account for the fact that Amazon.com, though its stock is very, very high, keeps losing money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a wonderful resource.
Yes. And my husband, who was a computer scientist and is a retired professor of computer science, was the head of the Department of the University of Massachusetts, which is a very large, excuse me, an important department, long wanted to get me onto a computer, and only about the last 5 years have I been on a computer.
Hmm.
But we're now putting up a website. And I think that for teachers, for students, to have a website that is really a research device for that, where they can find out information about me. I can give information about publishing, about writing, about my books, the ones in print as well as the ones out of print. That becomes a resource.
Do you have the address at this point?
No, we don't have a domain name yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only on my husband's website, which is at the University of Massachusetts. So it'll be moving soon, probably next week.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you test market your work? Do you read your work to your grandchildren, to a writer's group, to anyone?
My husband reads everything I do, and I am in a writer's group. There are seven of us, all women children's book writers, published children's book writers, and we meet once a week, and we read things out loud. The thing is that I can read picture books there and poems there, and maybe even a chapter or two of a novel, but I don't have time to read an entire novel there.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the time I read it to them, I'm already usually 4, 5, or 6, or 7 chapters ahead. I find novels are harder to workshop, I guess, in general.
Mm-hmm. Just because of the length and...
Well, yeah. Also, somebody can stop you in the middle of the forward movement of a novel by saying, oh, I didn't get that, or I don't understand that. And you spend so much time trying to spot fix that, that you lose the momentum, the forward momentum of the book. Better to have someone read the entire thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then tell you where it doesn't work, than to stop you during that time of creation.
So it sounds like you're saying that perhaps finish the thing first before you workshop it.
Of novels.
Right.
Of picture books, because you can complete and read the whole thing in one sitting.
Mm-hmm.
To a group. That's a very different kind of thing.
Will you read something else to us?
I thought that I would read the opening couple of pages, not the entire chapter, but the opening couple of pages of the Mary Queen of Scots book.
Great.
Which is called Queen's Own Fool, and will be out in May of this year. And it begins in France, actually, because that's where Mary Queen of Scots was until she was about 17, 18 years old. And it's chapter one, it's called M. The rain poured down throughout the day, hard and gray as cathedral stone. One by one we dragged to a halt. I stopped dancing first, then Annette, our skirts hanging in damp folds, tangling in our legs. It is like walking with dead fish, I said, slip, slap. Annette giggled, but then she found everything amusing, even in the rain. Taking the tin whistle from his lips, Bertrand flicked it several times, trying to rid it of water. Nadine's tambourine went still, and she shifted little Jean to her other hip. Now Pierre alone kept going, flinging the clubs into the air, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I wondered if he were going to try 7 at once, here on the drowned streets of Rennes, where no one would see him fail. What are you doing? Uncle Armand cried, and began hitting the rest of us for stopping. Troupe Buffot does not stop for mere rain. His hand was like some small, fierce, whey-colored animal, nipping and pinching where it could. Pierre dropped one of his rain-slicked clubs. It landed with a loud splash in a puddle at his feet. He stopped to pick it up. Uncle Armand turned and slammed Pierre on the head with the gold-topped cane. Clumsy fool! Did I tell you to stop? Stepping to Pierre's side, I began, but Uncle, there is no one in the street. Even the beggars have left the road to seek shelter. We have come to the holy city for nothing, and whap! This time the cane fell on my head, and I saw stars. Pierre had been smarter, going right back to his juggling. Would I never learn? One day Uncle would kill me with his cane. Mademoiselle La Bouche de Suze, Uncle said, meaning Miss Mouse from the South, says we have come to Rennes for nothing, but she is the nothing, not we. This time I bit my lip to keep from answering back. One day I swore I would break Uncle's cane over my knee. Uncle was not finished speaking, though. His nose wrinkled as if he had smelled something foul. We have come to Rennes for the young king's crowning. Fortunes will be made here. The new queen loves pageantry, songs, dances, mummery, all of which Troupe Beaufort can supply. But Uncle, I began, wanting to remind him that the city was draped in black for the old king's death. A lance in his eye while jousting, a wall-eyed beggar had said. The new king insists on a long mourning. So none of the grand folk racing to the coronation had heart or coins for street players. Dance, Uncle commanded. Now, good will come of it. Wet will come of it, I mumbled, but not so he could hear. So that's your introduction to Nicola Ambruzzi, who is one of the street players and becomes the queen's fool, who is known as La Jardinière.
Hmm. And give us the title again.
Queen's Own Fool.
Queen's
novel of Mary Queen of Scots.
Queen's Own Fool by Jane Yolen, and this is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and my guest is Jane Yolen. Process. Where do your ideas come from? You have millions of them.
One is always tempted to say, from a postdoc in Poughkeepsie. ideas, to me, the question is not where do ideas come from, because they are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The question is grabbing them and finding something to do with them. the example I always give my students is that back in the 70s, there was a rock group called Three Dog Night.
Yes.
That sang a song called Joy to the World that was on the airwaves everywhere. Great song. I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And one line was, I'm a deep sea diver, I'm a rainbow rider, I'm a sharpshooting son of a gun. Well, who knows how many people heard that song? How many people heard those lines? But I'm the only one who wrote a book called Rainbow Rider. Because I heard that, and just my mind just started going, what if, and that's the big storyteller's thing. What if there were a rainbow rider? Where would, what rainbows would he or she ride? Where would he or she ride to? Why is he or she on the rainbow? Is it lonely on that rainbow? All those questions that you sort of ask internally in order to find the story.
Mm-hmm. So, like with that line from the Three Dog Night song, does your mind naturally go into the what if or the question mode, or is that something that you now are in habit to do? What if this? What if that?
I think that it's something I've learned to get better and better at. I don't think I did it naturally to begin with because I was a poet. And as a poet, I think you are always looking for connections and conjunctions and likenesses and unlikenesses in life, in nature life.
Mm-hmm.
But as a storyteller, you're looking for what comes next. I think that those are two very different ways of looking at, quote, an idea. So that a poet seeing a tree is going to be looking at it for its metaphoric value or to explain life in terms of a tree. The storyteller says, who's up that tree and how do I get him down?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to learn to shift gears out of poetry and into story. I used to think that, I mean, I read stories all the time from the time I was a little kid. And I thought that people who could write stories were gods because I could write poetry. I couldn't write stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day, without even meaning to, I wrote a story and I went, that was fun. But in the beginning as a writer, when I was first finding my voice, I was finding my style, I was finding the stories I wanted to tell, I think I got as many ideas, but I couldn't prioritize. I couldn't tell which were viable ideas and which were just, a teeny bit of an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I've gotten better at over the years is knowing this is an idea worth following, worthy of my time. Maybe even an idea too big for me that I'm not ready for, but an idea that is worth doing something with. That's how I see it now. I mean, if you ask me tomorrow, I might have a total
different. You mentioned finding your voice. Talk a bit about finding your voice and your style.
Well, really, I think there are two voices that a writer has to find. One is sort of generically your own voice, and the other is the voice of the story. When they come together beautifully, that's the most wonderful thing. Sometimes a writer imposes a personal voice on a story that needs a different voice. Voice is the way you tell the story, but it's a combination of a lot of things. It's the diction, the words you choose, sometimes that's influenced by the point of view, who you're telling the story, whose point of view you're telling the story from. Sometimes it's kind of tonality within a sentence, whether that sentence has a kind of coruscating brilliance to it or whether it has a sort of a quiet, subtle, almost insinuating tone. My first discovery of my voice was a kind of folkloric voice in a book. I made a few stabs at it, but I think the book that I really first found it in was a book that I wrote called Grayling. which is a selfie story, so it was easy to get into the folkloric voice. But I had been a folk singer from the time I was very young. My father sang cowboy songs, and I had a cousin who used to run hoot nannies in the 50s. And I loved the old border ballads, the Scottish border ballads. So that was tonally where I really needed to start. And I think my most successful stories have either been that folkloric or the Owl Moon poetic voice.
In terms of folklore, that the wonderful compliment Newsweek magazine gave you, did you read lots and lots of folk tales and legends as a child, as a teenager, as an adult, as well as the music?
Yes. The books that I go back to over and over again as really influential were the Andrew Lang fairy color, the color fairy books.
Mm-hmm.
The blue fairy book, the green fairy book, the olive fairy book, the orange fairy book. When I look back at them now, from the point of view of a 20th and now a 21st century writer, I look at them and they appall me because this was 19th and early 20th century British colonialistic, imperialistic, anti-female, all those things, all those words that you can throw at it. There's just the undertone of all the stories is, but they're not British. These are nice stories, but these people aren't British. That kind of makes me uncomfortable, because when I tell stories now, if I'm taking them from another culture and working with them, I try to understand the culture. I try not to overlay my own American, 20th century, 21st century American value system on them, but to see where those stories go. But those were the first, the very, very first important influences. And then the Arthurian stories, which were mind-boggling. Absolutely. I thought they were the greatest stories ever told. And then when I was 8 or 9 years old, I discovered my parents had a boxed edition of Thomas Mann's Joseph in Egypt, which I sat and I read. I mean, I probably understood 3 words in 100, but I read it. I could not stop reading it. It was compulsive for me. I just sat, and we're talking massive for an 8-year-old, massive book. But it was so full of history and mystery and mythic proportion. But I, all through my elementary school and junior high and high school, folk lore or fantasy stories were very much a part of what I read.
What are you reading now?
Well, right now I'm actually a judge for the Edgar's Award in the young adult category. So mostly I'm reading young adult mystery stories right now. So that's not fair. This is not a fair question to ask.
But it's an interesting question, because I'm curious. I've known other judges of the Edgar's and various various awards, and I'm always interested in what keeps them reading, or what makes them, at what point do they put the manuscript down? So
these aren't in manuscripts, actually. These are the finished books.
Oh, okay.
I'm reading, we give an award to the best, the best book of the year, in adult and in children's and in nonfiction and that sort of thing. So I'm right now reading these books, so I don't really have time to read anything else. There were 40 books submitted, I think, or 40 or 45 something submitted to us. And it's a lot of books to read in a short period of time. Read carefully, not just read, but to read, and then you have to, it's not enough to say, I like about 6 or 7 of them. You have to be able to also decide which ones you like best and articulate with the other judges why you do. So,
When I was initially trying to reach you to come on the show, you were on tour, and then another time you were on tour again. You tour a lot.
Yes.
Don't you? You must love it.
I think touring is a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, there are two things that happened to me on tour, besides getting very tired and missing home in my own bed. One is I meet some wonderful people who then become friends for the rest of my life. And the other is you get to share your new books with people, which is a very exciting process. Sometimes it's a very scary process, and sometimes it's a terrible process. But you get to say, look, this is what I spent the last few years doing. I want you to know. Otherwise, the books may just never reach the people that you want them to reach.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, there are some people who have never gone out on tour. You know, you have your Thomas Pynchons and your Salingers. Joe Rowling didn't go on tour until after Harry Potter was squatting on top of the bestseller list like a gargoyle in a cathedral.
Jane, we're at the end of our time. Do you have any advice to writers?
People always want to know, what is the magic word? So I have developed it. The magic word is BIC, which means butt in chair. All the wishing to be a writer is not enough if you're not willing to do the hard work.
Mm. Yes. I thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You're a delight. Your work is wonderful. And come back sometime.
I will.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Jane Yolen, author of many, many books. Many wonderful books. And this is Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The show is internet accessible as well at KUCI.org. And all shows on KUCI are accessible on the internet. Next week, my guest will be literary author Ken Kalfas. So please come back 4 o'clock next Thursday. Stay tuned for Visionaries with Ava. And take care and remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.
Whatever habits you need that get you there and start the process, you know, the better it's going to be.
So and stop go ahead.
And do remember these two secrets. Think of talking, think of writing as talking on paper.
Hmm.
And then think of beginning at the end of what you're going to write. And by that I mean be able to just distill what you're going to write into one very concise, powerful sentence. You know, even novel writers are instructed to do this in approaching an editor. Certainly screenplay writers are instructed to do this when they have to go pitch to a producer. You have to be able to distill what you're going to write, and it's a great discipline. It actually gets our mind, I mean, you know, it's beneficial to all of our life if we will start the process of writing with these things in mind.
Yes. Sandra, I appreciate you coming on the show, and your book is just so useful, I think, especially with all of the examples of the different types of letters and forms and various things, and thank you.
Thank you.
Alrighty.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Goodbye.
That was Sandra Lam, author of How to Write It, published by 10 Speed Press. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The show is also internet accessible at KUCI.org. Visionaries is on next with Ava Park. And next week, my guest will be Teresa Lust, author of Pass the Polenta. Take care and thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about writing, not talking, but writing like there's no tomorrow.